Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What would you ask yourself if you were me?
What on earth were you thinking?
I like that. What on earth were you thinking?
I wasn't thinking. That's the point.
Vague, out of context. Like, what's going on? There's a lot of tension, drama, action, crime, suspense, all the things.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pod Friends. I'm Matt Scott, your host. That was Will from America performing the Pod Friends theme song. And today I'm here, as always, to have conversations with people in this Rob as a Podcast Network community, talking with people who make podcasts like this one a reality, talking with people who make this whole entire network of podcasts a reality. And today I'm thrilled for the conversation that I had with Sarah Carradine, who's this week's guest. And Sarah and I are pod in-laws or podcasters in-law, so to speak, in the sense that I co-host the Wrestling Rehab Up with the one and only Mari Forth, talking about pro wrestling. And Mari co-hosts the podcast Crime Scene, which talks about true crime media with Sarah Carradine. And so Sarah and I talked a little bit about Mari, but we mostly talked about Sarah's incredible backstory, which is one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about Pod Friends in these conversations, because while so often we talk about the shows that we love and the media that we consume, the reality is that there's so much more to the people in this community that we don't talk about or see or hear. And so we know that Sarah is a podcaster. She's a co-host of a podcast. She's also a writer, a director, an editor. She's produced Romeo and Juliet, and she's produced a number of theater performances all over the world, London, Edinburgh, New York, Boston, so on and so forth, even in Australia where she lives. And we talked about a lot in the conversation, which I'm excited for you to hear. But more than anything, I think when having the conversation with Sarah, I really felt like I was learning a lot and picking up a lot just on her perspective in life as someone who, outside of podcasting, again, is a writer for performance art and a creative nonfiction writer, a director, someone who appreciates ocean swimming and swim coaching and all the above. You know, it was cool to see the ways that Sarah's mind works as a creator and to connect the dots to hopefully some helpful lessons for all of you. And, you know, Sarah is someone who I hope that folks on this network are only just beginning to hear from, because there is so much more she has to share and draw from. And this was a really meaningful conversation, which touched on a lot, including the reason why she always does these land acknowledgements, or acknowledgements of country, as they're called in Australia, which recognize the indigenous or Aboriginal communities whose land it belonged to before today's day and age. We talk about just so many different topics through Sarah's experiences in life. And this was really a unique one. And so I hope that you're tuned in. I hope to hear from you about what you think. If you want to let me know what you're thinking and who you want to see on Pod Friends, And anything else, you could tweet me at Hey Pod Friends or at Matt Scott GW to let me know. It's always great to hear who's on the other end. Always great to hear what you're thinking. So speaking of which, I actually just want to give a couple of shout outs to folks who have left reviews. And they're also kind. I want to give a disclaimer. I'm not reading this to just pump myself up, but more than anything else to shout out the folks who are listening and supporting and to encourage folks to go to robhiswebsite.com/podfriendsfeed in order to subscribe to the podcast, but also to please give those 5 stars and leave a review with what you're thinking and how this resonates with you. That's really the most meaningful part of Pod Friends for me. And speaking of which, here is a review, the most recent one from Mandy, who writes, and I'll read this just because I appreciate it so much, Mandy. Matt Scott is a treasure. Protect him at all costs. Thanks, Matt, for always providing such insightful and entertaining conversations with RHP podcasters. It's so great to get to know the people behind the voices, most commonly in my ear, including Matt. Don't stop until we've heard from all the podcasters, then keep it going with life updates when there's no one left. Yes, that's how I feel. I want to hear from all of the podcasters. I have a long, long list of interviewees, and hopefully we'll have the time, the energy, the mic, the whatever else it takes to record these interviews to keep going for a long, long while to talk with everybody and maybe talk with some folks again. Jill Fitz writes, beautiful conversations. I was choked up listening to the conversation between Matt and T-Bird. Beautiful conversations every time. Thank you so much for that. And one more I'll read. Pelican Pablo writes, great podcast, great host. As a longtime RHAP fan, I love this series, getting to know my friends in my head. Matt's a great interviewer, and I can't wait to listen to every episode, every season. That is, you are all too kind, and I appreciate you. And again, as I try to convey each episode, I just want to send a lot of love to all of you who are on this journey with me. Not even talking about the shows, just about the people who are in this thing. And I'm just so grateful for all of you. And again, leave a review and I might read it on the podcast. I will definitely read it and maybe even get a little choked up reading some of these because you all are way too sweet to me. So thanks a lot, everyone. And just as some final reminders, you could watch on YouTube, robhiswebsite.com/YouTube. You could suggest a guest at bit.ly/podfriendsnom. And it is the start of the month. Great time to become a Rob Has a Podcast patron, which you could do at robhiswebsite.com/Patreon, which is phenomenal because it is Big Brother season. If you're a fan of Big Brother, there is exclusive content there for you to tune in and hear from podcasters, hear from Rob Cesternino, the Rob of Rob Has a Podcast, and to join a community where you get to know people and bond with patrons. I recently just watched a patron Brant Steele where patrons were simulating a game of Big Brother, and that was really fun. And so, so many opportunities to make new friends, connect with people, and so much more. Again, robhiswebsite.com/Patreon. And I will follow up with more plugs after the interview with Sarah, but just want to thank you all for being on this Pod Friends journey with me and for following along each and every step of the way. But without further ado, here is my conversation with Sarah Carradine. Making her way to the podcast, hailing from Sydney, New South Wales, Australia, unceded Gadigal land, she is the co-host of Crime Scene, reviewing true crime media on RHAP with the one and only Mari Forth, robhiswebsite.com/crimefeed, as well as a theater virtuoso, a connoisseur of the performing arts, a writer, director, editor of audio, visual, and textual platforms. Please welcome the Barb of RHAP, and I'm talking Shakespeare, not Nicki Minaj. Please welcome Sarah Carradine.
I had this thought and this realization when you were on the Wrestling Rehab Up back in October of 2021. Because every time I do my little podcast intro and I search, like, what should I say about people? And I just searched your name. I found so much. There were so many things. I just listened back to like the intro that I gave you. And I mentioned that you are a patron, a podcaster, a writer, a director, an editor of audio. I said audio, textual, and visual formats.
Oh,
fancy. Yes, salacious. And so there's so much there, and I'm excited to be able to dive into it. But
we'll I have a question
there.
For you.
Yeah.
Why did you invite me on the wrestling wrap up? I was so like, that was one of my favorite things still that I've ever done on the network. Gosh. But yeah. Why?
Yeah. Well, I will say inside baseball for people, Mari does all of the booking for the wrestling wrap up. She does all of the hard work, but we invited you because our thing with the wrestling wrap up, especially as we started, was let's have as many different RHAP podcasters and class of 2020 members and just pull them in and have them on. Because for a lot of us, like, we were, you know, just a year and a half into being on RHAP, and there were so many of us, but also so few podcasts in comparison to all of us. So it's like, let's bring people on, let's get to know them, and let's also like give our little wrestling wrap up audience a chance to get to know them. And, you know, since we're talking about that, you kind of blew my mind on that episode, which I don't know if you realized how mind-blowing it was. You are not a wrestling fan, or you were not a wrestling fan before the episode. Do you consider yourself a wrestling fan now?
No, but when wrestling Twitter floats down my timeline, I kind of have an idea of what's going on.
Because of Mari. Obviously, of Mari, your co-host on Crime Scene. So
yes.
There was so much that you got into, and the way that you talk about wrestling was sort of mind-blowing for me, because it was really theatrical in many ways. And I don't think that a lot of people appreciate wrestling and the art of it. From your perspective, I'm going to put you on the spot, Sarah, as a non-wrestling fan who has wrestling permeate your life, and who also is possibly part of the longest wrestling wrap-up episode at 3.5 hours. We did have a lot to say back then. We've gotten older over time, mostly me. Mari stays young, but I've gotten older, and you know, we have to do a little bit less. We try to stick to like 2 hours now. But I want to ask for you, you know, what is it about wrestling that is so, that resonates with you? I know that it doesn't resonate with you that much, but I want to ask, because you spoke about it in such an artful way. It kind of it kind of shocked me a little bit, actually. I wasn't used to people talking about like the theatrical element and then the stage that is the wrestling ring and so on and so forth. And then the lighting, all of it. But yeah, what is it for you that stuck out about the weird, wild, whimsical world of professional wrestling when you were on with us?
Well, I'd never been anti-wrestling. I'd never like actively avoided it or anything like that. I was aware of wrestling. Who isn't?
Sure.
And I was so charmed to be invited onto the podcast, charmed and confused. Mm. And then you and Mari sent me clips, which I watched, and I watched them like I would any film or play or piece of art, because that's the way my eyes and my brain work. That's how I sort of receive media, but also the world to a certain extent. So I approach things with positivity. Like if I'm in a theater and the lights go down and it's dark, there's that moment of this could be the most extraordinary thing that I have ever seen in my life.
Wow.
And despite having seen lots and lots and lots of rubbish, lots of ill-conceived stuff, lots of stuff that isn't good enough, and sometimes paid a lot of money for the privilege, it doesn't matter how many times I sit and the lights go down, or it could be the cinema, or I could push play on Netflix, or whatever it might be, I think it could be this extraordinary thing. And just this week, we're recording on my 30th of June, the end of the financial year here in Australia. I recently saw two shows. I don't know if you have this, but we call it profit share. It's like a cooperative of artists that come together and there's no funding and they share the proceeds. And these can be very ill-conceived or they can be wonderful. It was one of the best things I've ever seen. The the script was wonderful and the production was like, even if you did a professional production, you're not going to change that much, the set and the costumes and everything. That was very moving and wonderful, and I cried, which is nice. And the other was a Brisbane company called Circa. It's not going to mean anything except to our Australian listeners, who are kind of a combo circus burlesque group of young people tumbling around and standing on each other and doing extraordinary things. So some people I was with who were, you know, theatre people, they were saying, well, it's fine, but where's the narrative? Narrative? The narrative is these incredible people doing this wonderful performance, engaging with us. Like every time they'd do something particularly spectacular, they'd look at us and give us a little cheeky, yeah, did that. And they have the same four limbs and body as we do, but this is what they choose to do with it. And it was, to me, it was beauty and poetry and humor and all of that. So I think what somebody demands from a show, I am getting to the point. What someone demands from a show is different depending on your background, and some people are very, yeah, I am theatre, where is the narrative? Mm-hmm. But the thing about wrestling is you want a narrative. There are narratives aplenty. I mean, mm-hmm, this is raw human emotion. I might have said, I can't remember what I said on the wrestling wrap-up, but to me, the emotion, the connection, the story and the art were all very elevated. And then you add to that this incredible physical facility that they have. I mean, are they athletes? Are they dancers? Are they acrobats? They're all those things. And then the thoughtfulness of the costuming and how the relationship between, right, people is expressed in color and all of that sort of stuff. So I, as I say, I hadn't been anti-wrestling, but I hadn't ever sat and put my mind and my eyes and my heart onto watching people wrestling, as you and Mari asked me to do. And when I did, it was just completely delightful. I just loved it.
Yeah, I think it's so fascinating to me. And one reason I ask you about wrestling is not to turn this into a wrestling podcast. This is not the wrestling wrap up. But you know, I ask because I think that, you know, this community is really lucky to have so many different perspectives, but one of them being yours, absolutely, just bringing that lens of performance, of the arts, of so many different things within this. And so I don't want to bury the lead with this. Could you kind of like sum up what your background is when it comes to all of the, I'll say the performing arts maybe as the umbrella, because that's, wow, the thing that I think a lot of people don't know about you. And, you know, I got a sense of it going into the wrestling rehab, but I don't think I've heard you on a podcast talk about these things extensively.
Well, You did ask me off pod, like, what's something that people would be surprised to hear, and I put something. But what I really wanted to put was, you know, I don't like talking about myself. You wonder why I'm on Pod Friends. Well, Matt and I are pods in law because we share, yes, a co-host in the incredible Mari Forth.
Yes.
You see how I just like turned away from
you? You went to Mari rather than talking about yourself.
And when I stopped after saying her name, I was thinking, now what's the next thing I'm going to say about Mari? And then I thought, no, man, ask me about myself.
I want to say, by the way, before you dive into that, I think that it's interesting because a lot of us talk so much on podcasts that people might just assume that we love to talk about all of ourselves all the time, which could be an incredibly vulnerable thing to do. And so I appreciate you acknowledging that it's not always natural to just talk about yourself. But the good news is you are trapped in this recording right now. There's no way you could leave. You're trapped in the Pod Friends box. Maybe some people are watching on YouTube. Beautiful mime, now I'm like just voguing at this point, but yes. How do you sum yourself up? Like, what's, if I asked you, like, how do you introduce yourself, or how do you sum up those, like, the things that kind of are more fitting for a bio? What would that be?
Well, there's the short answer and then there's the long answer. So the short answer would be I would introduce myself with whatever I'm doing currently. Mm-hmm. So I now say, hi, I'm Sarah. I'm a podcaster. I podcast about pop culture. Yes. And that's only recent. So even after being accepted into the class of 2020, one of the most brilliant moments of my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure some listeners know, some may not. We recently were all together in New York, not absolutely everybody, but there is a photo exists of some of the class of 2020. And I was like, oh yeah, here we all are. And that was a very interesting process because I really wanted to apply, but I thought, I don't fit what Rob, the head of the network is looking for. There's a certain diversity that he is wanting, and great that he did ask for that. So I looked at the form a couple of times and I thought, oh, I just don't fit. And then at the last minute, I filled it in. And I heard somebody else tell you that at the last minute they filled it in.
Oh, I think that might have been me.
Maybe. Ah, okay. You when you were talking to Beth. Yeah, it was you when you were talking to Beth. And because there was a little slot to write, you know, what is your diversity? So I loved how overt that was. So I just wrote age. And...
Being humble a little bit, but
I mean, you know, what I had found was often listening. So I don't. Here's a secret, everybody. You don't go around thinking about how old you are. Now, you younger people probably don't either. It's just that you don't realize that you don't. But when you're older, you really realize that you don't think about how old you are until something comes up. And the things that were coming up for me listening to, you know, across a lot of podcasts on RHAP is things that are in my pop culture, not just memory, but I actually lived through them. I have a lot of access to. So when I would hear people, you know, fumbling for a reference or getting things slightly wrong, not being like a punisher to say, oh, they got it wrong. But that idea of had I been on that podcast, I could have told you immediately what that was.
Right.
So when I wrote that my diversity was age, it was slightly a joke, but it was also what I felt was one of the things that I could bring to the network and what I could bring to podcasting. Because it's not just the accumulated knowledge of, you know, the 75 years that I've been on Earth, but also... but also, it's not just,
that was a joke. That was a joke.
That was a joke. That was a joke.
And the smooth one that I almost didn't catch for a second.
Like, I gave you the wink and the thumb up.
Yes.
Not just like what, just no, not just knowledge, but also, you know, I'm very pleased to be, I'm very lucky and honored to be invited onto the Married at First Sight podcast. And, the comment that I get both from the hosts there, Jason and Asia, but also from the listeners is, oh, you know, you're so, they don't quite say wise, but that's what they mean.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. It just is having been around for a while and having thought, if you think about things, you have time, you've had time to think about things, you've had time to experience things yourself, you've had time to see friends and other people in certain circumstances, and you've had time to form thoughts. If that's all that wisdom is, then yes, I'm wise. So I feel like I definitely thought I can bring, you know, the pop culture references of a longer period of time to the network. But also now I realize that I do, you know, I have had thoughts and I still get things wrong, but I really like being schooled, especially live on podcasts, you know, for my unthinkingness. I like the way that that the group of people that podcast on this network think. I like the way that we ask each other to think and then ask the audience to think as well. And we don't all agree on everything. We're not a mob, everybody.
Right.
We don't agree on everything. So I would now, coming back to your question, introduce myself as a podcaster. Mm-hmm. But prior to, even after I was accepted into the class of 2020, I would have said I was a swim coach. And before that, I would have said, but, you know, I've had many jobs. This is not new to people working now, but it's unusual for people of my generation. We were sort of the last to get a job and stay in it or see a career as a ladder. And I know that thought is still there, but your career, your working life is not a ladder, I'm here to tell you. And mine certainly has never been a ladder. And I appreciate that about myself, and I appreciate that about my young self, who kind of saved my own life and escaped at a young age, left home at 17. And I said this on another podcast. I see 17-year-olds now go, "Oh my God, that's so young!" Like, not young because I'm old, but yeah, but that I was 17 and I was entirely responsible for myself. Mm-hmm. I've been working since I was 15, which I just say as a fact, and I'm glad to have it. But oh my God, I've been working for a very long time, everybody.
There's so many twists and turns, first of all, and I'm like, but like, yeah, what kind of, I actually want to kind of pause you for a second because I don't want to miss this. So what did you begin doing when you were 15? I'm on the journey with you.
So when I was 15, I got a job in a very large stationery bookshop, and one of the things that I remember about that job was I typed a letter of application and put it in an envelope and put a stamp on it and posted it, and they typed a letter back to me saying, "Yes, you start on this day," having never seen each other, spoken on the phone, nothing like that. So I turned up to work, and we had a Bundy clock. I don't know if people know what a Bundy clock is. I think if you've ever watched The Flintstones, if you've ever watched any of those shows set in the past, you go along, there's a series of cards, there's a card with your name on it, you pull that out and you stick it into a slot, and it goes clunk, and it says what time it's a sign on.
System. Like a time card or time sheet.
It's a time
machine,
card.
Right?
It's a time machine. We're in a time machine now. I'm taking you back. I love that. It's a time machine.
Time
and
machine. Yes.
So start time was 9 o'clock, and all the time prior to 9 o'clock was in black. So 8:50 would be in black. But if you bundied on at 9, it would be red. So any time after 9 would be red, I suppose. So the person who was looking to pay you could see. And I remember there was a gaggle of what I thought of as middle-aged women, but God, they might have been 30 or 40. But in those days, 30-year-olds were like old. And they were a gang, because one of them each day would bundy on and off, because you had to bundy off at the end as well to show that you were still at work at the time you should have been at work. Mm-hmm. So they would have nominated a day each to take all their cards and bundy on and bundy off, so that the rest of them could swan in late and swan out early. And I thought, wow, that's fantastic. Sticking it to the man. So that was my first job. And then I was out on my own. I wanted to, put a stick with a knotted handkerchief on the end of it with all my belongings over my shoulder and work in the theatre. Because I had fallen amongst theatre folk in my mid-teens, and I knew they were my family. I thought, oh, I didn't think I belonged anywhere. This is where I belong. And I met someone who, I don't know if I knew what gay was, and certainly queer in those days was a slur.
Yeah.
But I met a young man who was, I think about him now, wow, he was overtly gay, let's say, whatever that means.
Right.
Flamboyant, I suppose we used to say in those days. And even though I didn't really know what gay was, what queer was, what any of that stuff was, I knew he was gay. Like, I don't know how I had television shows that showed me what gay men were, which was incredibly flamboyant and, ooh, ducky and all of this sort of thing. Always alone, never, centered, never with partners. Never serious. So perhaps television had taught me to recognize him, and I just adored him, absolutely adored him, and thought he was incredible. He was in the theater. I found the theatre and I found theatre people and I found my people. And so that was really the beginning. So I feel like I was maybe an egg for 16 and a half years.
Yeah.
And then I was in a stasis chamber. I do remember from quite a young age. I don't have a lot of memories of my childhood for reasons, but one of the things I do remember from about 10 on was calculating how soon I could leave my home. Yeah. And so in a way it was sort of, and I was very good. You know, I tried to fly under every radar possible because I knew that I was escaping. It was like, I love heist movies and I do love prison escape movies. And there's that thing of the patience with which you have to, you know, husband your resources. So, you know, you can't stick your head above the parapet. You have to wait and give no indication of your plans. And then when you're ready to go, you go. And, you do leave surprise and some devastation behind. And for that, I wish it had been other, but there isn't another way that I could have gotten out, I suppose. So,
yeah.
So it was as if I was in stasis and then I broke open. So maybe that's why I'm so youthful, because you can minus 16 and a half years from my age.
Look, and I think that this, it's really powerful that you share that, even just, and a lot of people I know can relate to that idea of breaking out of wherever they're coming from. And I know that not only because through Pod Friends, I've heard from listeners who can relate to people who have some of those elements to their story, but also because for a lot of people, this community and these shows and the media that we love and we cover and that we talk about together as podcasters and listeners in the community, it can be an escape for people. And, you know, one thing I'm kind of curious about in all of that is, like, I mean, you kind of had the path that you had, but, like, looking back at it, is there any... This is very much like a RuPaul's Drag Race question. Just picture me holding up a picture of you as a child. Like, is there advice or that, is there wisdom, back to what you were saying earlier about wisdom, but is there wisdom that you'd have for your younger self at that time where things were, you know, more, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but, you know, not as straight and more challenging?
Look, you know, you are born where you're born and into the circumstances that you're born into, if you are born. And I think the advice, I can't really give her advice because she did the right thing, which is just hold on, it will get better. I was very moved with the slogan, you know, it gets better, because I think that's something certainly friends of mine didn't heed in those days, that everything passes. I'm of the belief that we just go back where we came from. When we die, we go back where we came from. If you think about where you were before you were conceived, that's where we go. And to me, that's not frightening. To me, that's elevating, because I think that means this is it. Where we are now is it. So let us work together and uplift each other and help each other and love each other. But I'm also quite practical about how things are. And I think that combination has kind of got me through. What would I say? I said, look, you've got it. You saved yourself. Well done. I really admire that. Where did that kind of boldness come from? It's extraordinary. Just you do you. And one of the best things I do remember too, one of the best things that happened to me in my late teens, early 20s, because I didn't know anything. I mean, I didn't know anything. And I was working in a theatre. I was working as a stage manager and I had found my people, as I say. And, you know, it was the afterwards I loved, the drinks afterwards as people sat around and talked and people would mention things, like they might mention, I don't know, for example, they might mention Kafka. And I think, no idea who that is. But I would wait for somebody else to ask And then I would sort of have a sort of, oh, that you don't know, while I listened very eagerly to find out. Or I would say that I'd seen films that I hadn't seen and stuff like that. I wanted so much to belong because I recognized them, my family, my theater family, my queer family, as we say now. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know if they recognized me. And then I remember distinctly at some point saying that I didn't know something. Mm-hmm. And the conversation just moved on as if nothing had happened. But it was an absolute earthquake for me that I didn't have to know everything. I didn't have to be right. I didn't have to be good. I didn't have to be, you know, all the things. I mean, you can escape your home, the where you have been growing up, but escaping the tyranny of the expectations and the training and upbringing that you've been given is harder.
So it for me to see you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so that was one of the things that I remember really clearly. And that's in a way, like I don't think about it every day, but it's informed how I move through the world, you know, with curiosity and with pleasure at meeting other people and with not knowing. I think I love not knowing and I love being told and I love finding out. So now, and going back to my application for class of 2020, mm-hmm. it takes a lot for me to go, I actually know about this stuff. I'm so used to being the one that doesn't know and the one that asks and the one who's curious and the one who finds out that it's really nice now to go, well, I actually know about this. Like I know about this and this is part of my knowledge. And I don't have to tell you if you don't want to hear it. But if you do want to hear it, then I'll tell you, because I believe in generosity, and part of generosity is sharing your knowledge or sharing your experience or just sharing your presence. You don't have to advise people if they don't want it. You can just sit with them. Anyway, there are a few swirling thoughts there.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting because part of what I'm hearing from you, and it maybe overall, is that theater was this, and again, I always, what it sounds like to me is that theater was a bit of an escape in a way from kind of what you were navigating, but also built these beautiful things in you that kind of helped you navigate the world to this day. So it wasn't only, you know, a thing that would separate you from trauma and struggle, but also build you into like the beautiful person that you are today and that you continue to grow into. And so I am curious though, like thinking of what theater has meant for you overall, like are there things that you've been most proud of in your career? And you know, I only know a little bit about what I've seen in bios and the like, but I know about the Dirty Underground Cabaret. Mm-hmm. I know about Romeo and Juliet. Mm-hmm. I know about London and Edinburgh and New York and Boston and all the places you've traveled doing this, but like, are there things that you're most proud of? I want you to brag on yourself a little bit. And I'm also curious, just because it has been this beautiful, I don't know if the word's generative, but it's been this thing that's blossomed into, a life for you. Right. And so I'm curious what jumps out as, I'm going to look back and be really proud about those things.
Well, I mean, it's curious that I'm doing Pod Friends because I don't tend to look back very much. I sometimes feel like I'm just starting. I'm just starting this strange thing. Like we're all here. What are we doing? I think that your resume, if everything is true, and everything on my resume is true, it really doesn't tell the story of what the things were. I mean, I might start with Romeo and Juliet, which is an opera by a Frenchman called Charles Gounod. Not the style of opera that I particularly go to. It's a very lush, overblown French opera of the very late 19th century. It was written in 1899. And I did this as a production for Opera Australia. So if any of you listeners know the Shells of the Sydney Opera House, I used to work there. I worked there a lot. And there's a thing where you approach that building. Well, I do. And the sails look different in different lights, depending on if it's sunny or rainy or cloudy or what time of day it is. I mean, it is an beautiful, beautiful place.
Yeah,
on iconic. The outside, it's iconic. And so on you walk outside. Towards it and you go, oh, my God, I work there. And then you go inside and you go, oh, yeah, that's right, I work in here. because, as we say, Australia has the perfect opera house. The outside's in Sydney, the inside's in Melbourne, and the parking's in Adelaide. And that's true because I've worked in all those houses and I've worked in Brisbane and Perth as well. So I've worked in all the houses in Australia, and they all have their charms. But the Sydney Opera House opera stage is a very, very tricky stage to work on because the architect designed a bigger stage for the opera and a slightly smaller stage for the orchestra. And at the time, because of politics, the orchestra was more powerful than the opera, so they swapped over. So the opera stage has no wings. If you work in the theatre, you know what that is. If you don't, it's the bit to the side that the audience can't see, where a performer might wait or a big piece of stage machinery might be hidden from the audience. And so it does make it very tricky. Anyway, Romeo and Juliet. We all know the story. It's beautiful, lush, overblown French operatic. And I did find myself in a rehearsal room with nearly 100 people and in charge of everybody. I'm very proud of that. I do like to let everybody in a rehearsal room contribute. But when you have a chorus of 50 and 10 principals and 12 actors and music staff, and you actually have to be a bit more like, you can't do theatre by committee, I suppose. I'm about to do a play in Adelaide, in Hobart in Tasmania. It's a new Australian play. Shout out Alison Mann, who's an incredible young writer. I've known her for a number of years, and she brought this play to me. Well, she didn't bring the play to me. She showed me a paragraph. She was supposed to be writing something else. She showed me a paragraph. She said, I don't know what this is. I said, well, whatever it is, when you write it, I want to direct it. And so, yeah, so I went down to shoot some promo shots with the cast. And I thought, oh, four people, this is really nice. But I also, modest and moderate though I am, there is something about standing in a room full of, you know, nearly 100 people and have them all listen to you. Because one thing about an opera rehearsal room, it's very quiet. People listen. It's very, very hierarchical. Opera is very hierarchical. I'm not a huge opera fan, by the way. This may shock you.
Well, but I mean, well, when you mentioned the hierarchy, I'm like, okay, I can't picture you being a super hierarchical person.
I'm not, but opera is. Opera is stupid because it costs a huge amount of money. You can't scale it. It's like you can't say, well, there are 10 singing roles, but we'll do it with 5 people. You can't do it. If it's 10 people, it's 10 people. If it's a chorus of 50, it's a chorus of 50. And it's elitist. There's no, I don't ever see an invitation in for people, you know, to come to an opera. And you are expected to sit at the opera in complete silence. And you are expected to know when to clap and know when to cheer and know what the story is. I mean, the introduction of surtitles, which is the English translation of what they're singing going above the stage, is good. I think opera could be incredible, but it's not. Look, opera is incredible. It could be inclusive, but I don't know where the will is, certainly in Australia, to bring people in. Having said that, there's a company called Pinchgut Opera, And Pinchgut is the name of a place when Australia was invaded by Europeans. Pinchgut was a place where, yeah, you were a bit hungry. So I love that it's Pinchgut Opera. Mm-hmm. And they do Baroque opera in a wonderful, the productions are fantastic. The audience is invited in. But still, let's go to a musical. That's what I say. But it's still, it's not the pinnacle of my career, but it's one of the things I'm really proud of is my production of Romeo and Juliet and the time that I spent making it. We did it in Sydney, we did it in Melbourne, Perth and Adelaide. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I have complicated feelings about opera. I don't know that the people who work for and in the opera are looked after as they should be. I think mm-hmm. their respect for artists is not as high as it should be. And the emotional safety of the I worked as a guest artist for Opera Australia for 20 years. So you think I'm sort of biting the hand that fed me. But there was a certain situation that I couldn't tolerate. And it wasn't a treatment of me. It was a treatment of the people in the company. And I basically said sayonara over that, giving up a very, very lucrative contract. I don't regret that for a moment. And it makes me sad because I think opera could be amazing. I mean, what if mm-hmm. what if you brought children into a rehearsal room and let them touch things and let them talk to the singers while they're singing? And I don't know, just ask. So I'm going to take you back to when I was about 5.
Ooh.
Here we go.
I'm on the journey. I'm on the ride. Journey. I feel like, you know, we're bouncing around a little, but I will go back to when you were 5.
It's the way my brain works. And I also want to get off bashing opera because I haven't really, I can't really explain what I mean, but one of the things is the elitism and the money of it. And also I've seen how the sausage is made and I've seen how you can pay, here's an inside opera. You can pay $400 for a show that was rehearsed for a week and the performers mm-hmm. on stage are talking to each other to tell each other where to go because the audience, you can't hear them because the orchestra's so loud. And I think, you know, somebody's paying a huge amount of money to see something that you slapped together. I don't approve. When I was 5, I was taken to a little show. And I don't remember the story of it, but I can tell you there were 4 performers. There were 2 men and 2 women. And there was a little line of footlights. If people don't know what that is, that's literally on the floor lights between the audience and the performers that shine up. It's sort of an old-fashioned thing, but I absolutely love footlights. They do things for the lighting. And it must have been a prince and princess sort of story because at the end, the king and the queen were there and the prince and the princess were going to marry each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course. And then the king and the queen and the princess said, well, of course, you have to have a dance at a wedding. And they would each like a child to come up and be their partner for the dance. Mm-hmm. Well, I was completely thrilled. I was beside myself. I wanted to dance with the prince, but the king chose me. But okay, that's fine. It's a metaphor come to life. I stepped over the footlights and the man, the older man, I don't know, he would have been, let's say in his 40s, terribly, terribly old to me. And he held both my hands with both of his hands to help me step over the footlights. And I was looking at my feet so I didn't stumble. And I looked up into his face, and now, instead of a king, I saw an old man or older man with very thick Leichner makeup on. This is stage makeup that is out of favor now, and sweat running, digging rivulets through this makeup, which is not what he looked like when I'd been out in the audience. He had been a king. And I looked up. And there was this man in makeup. And I said to myself, oh, it's a job.
5-year-old you.
I didn't, I didn't realize it was a job.
Huh.
And so that was my sort of awakening to theater, and that it was the place for me. I stepped over the footlights onto the stage and I saw that it's just a job. It's a job that people do. And so when we say now, you know, you can't be it if you can't see it, that's largely true. And it was certainly true for me because I saw right. that it was a job. It was something you could aspire to do. And so I did aspire to do it. So when I think about how, you know, you could bring children to the opera, you don't do it by getting them to put on a scratchy, you know, party dress that they don't mm-hmm. want to wear and sit in silence while people, strangely dressed people, bellow in foreign language at them. Although there'll be another little person who goes, and then that's the same, you know, yeah. revelation that I had. So let me not speak for their experience.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's fascinating, though, to kind of hear how what's kind of led you, the pieces that have led you to that realization and to this thing that you're passionate about. And I think one of my big questions is the one things I'm thinking about that listeners are probably thinking about is how that relates to, you know, what you do within RHAP, because I mean, the opera and theater are so different than Big Brother, with the Big Brother season coming up, for example, or so different than like a lot of the things that we're used to talking about and obsessing over and focusing on. Like, what is it that you love or enjoy about like the media that we cover within this podcasting universe, and how does that relate to the other things that you love outside of it in terms of theater? Just to start there.
Well, first of all, it's not different. It's exactly the same.
What's the same exactly about the same. It?
Exactly the same. Well, it's the narrative that we look for. So, all right. So human beings are pattern seeking animals. Mm. It's the way our brains work, and it's about our continued, you know, ability to live and avoid predators and not eat the wrong berries and all of that. We look for patterns because that is about our survival. You know, last time I heard that rumbling, a great light was in the sky and a tree caught on fire. So when I hear the rumbling again, I recognize the pattern and I move away from the lightning strike. That's also partly our downfall because we look for patterns, we see meaning where there isn't meaning.
Right.
Conspiracies. Come from this. People say, oh, it was a sign that I should do this or I should not do this
right.
because of this.
Right.
Those patterns and our learning from them are why we like theatre and entertainment, because we look for meaning. And when it's a curated meaning, like an opera, very satisfying. She dies and we cry. Or it's a comedy, so they get married and we're all happy mm-hmm. and the world is right. In Big Brother, we yeah. say, what's the story? Whether you think it actually or not, the way we talk about on this network but also elsewhere, we're either thinking, I'm glad I'm not that. So I'm being shown a very chaotic house. And my house that I live in is not that chaotic.
I was going to say, chaotic. That is very much the, that I think that sums up most of what I've seen in Big Brother. Very chaotic. So
glad it's not me or whatever it is right. that you might think. But we also want to know, like, I think that human beings are deeply curious. I think it gets battered out of us in various ways, various times. So, but one of our curiosities is what makes ourselves and each other tick. We are not the only animals who have self-reflection. We are not the only animals that recognize ourselves in a mirror. There have been very interesting studies see that other animals recognize themselves in mirrors. And you can tell that because if you put something on their forehead, they don't point to the mirror. They pick the thing off their own head. So we aren't the only ones that self-reflect, but we do self-reflect and we do look outside ourselves for meaning, which is where you get cults from, and it's where you get toxic relationships because someone provides us meaning, therefore we no longer have to think. But it's also where a lot of our positive aspects come from, to say, what, why are we here? And as I said before, I mean, I'm an atheist, and I suppose I'm very slightly a nihilist. Ooh. We're only here. There is no meaning to our life. We are biological creatures. Having said that, I think because we are looking for patterns, we provide our own meaning. And that's what I love about us as humans. There's no meaning that's going to be handed down to us from outside. But what we do is look for, well, if that is the case, what can I do while I'm here? What do I provide myself with the meaning for my own life? And I'll let you know when I've figured it out. Yeah. But this is, for me, where kindness and generosity comes from. Don't be kind and generous because somehow you'll get approval from outside. Be kind and generous because that's something that you want to do. It's the world that you want to create. I suppose that's the larger thing is, if we are providing our own meaning, then we have to say, what world do we want to create, and set about creating that world. So, you know, and it's very interesting. I have a neurodivergent friend, and I remember when he was much younger, he couldn't figure out sharing because, and I thought, well, actually, he's absolutely right, because, in fact, as a young creature, sharing is antithetical to your continued survival. So if there are three of you, you shouldn't be sharing. You should be getting all the resources for yourself, because then your genes will be the ones that continue. But in the society as we've constructed it, sharing's a really good idea. And I said to him, well, if you share, maybe they'll share with you. Aha, the light bulb went off, both in him and myself.
Yeah.
Because we rely on each other. So you could say that is a very selfish thing. I will share. I will give you half my piece of cake, Matt, and then you will pour half your coffee into my cup, and now we're both happy. Yes, I'm getting something from that, but we're also creating community between us by doing that. And it's interesting that I say food, because, you know, sharing food is such a basic and vital thing that we do, because we do rely on each other. No person is an island, although we might feel like islands. So I think that if we are thinking about what is the meaning of our lives, or not what is the meaning, but what meaning can we bring to our lives, then we are thinking in terms of how we create a world that we want to live in. And, you know, again, biologically, we are small group primates. So we find a small group that we can be interdependent upon. So we are both ensuring our own survival, but we are mutually ensuring each other's survival. And one of the interesting things about the modern world, the 21st century, if that's what we're up to, is we're small group primates, but we live in a very large group, not just in big cities. I'm an urban girl. I love the city. I never want to move to the country. I don't want to have a tree change or a sea change or a weed change. I will live in an apartment for the rest of my life because I absolutely love it. And I am vital, revitalized by cities, and I love them. So not only do we physically live with a large number of people, but we're also in contact with a large number of people, both people that we actually know, like the RHAP universe. We know each other, but also I listen to podcasts. I know those, like outside the network, I know those people. They don't know me. They have no idea who I am. So we are small group primates, but we are compelling ourselves to live in a very large group. So even more so, I think we should think about how we want to conduct ourselves in the world that we want to live in.
I'm curious to see how people make meaning of what you've shared or what you're sharing in this podcast. I'm curious, like, very tangibly, how did you discover RHAP, first of all? Wow. And then, you know, what's been your RHAP journey so far?
This is something I love talking about. So, well, not my journey, but RHAP. I do love talking about it. So some years ago, like, I never know when I became a patron, and I look on Patreon and it doesn't tell me, so I'm not sure if I find out. Some years ago, How do I do the short version of this question? So when you're in a field, you know other people in the field. Mm-hmm. And I have a friend who's the best television writer in Australia, if not the world. She's incredible. And her husband is a film and TV director. And they both separately happened to get jobs in Melbourne at a time when their three children were 15, 17 and 19. Mm-hmm. So old enough to be left alone, but not for, you know, a month, even though they were coming home on weekends. So the children were asked, you know, which adult they would tolerate.
Yeah.
Kind of dropping in once or twice a week and making them dinner and staying the night. And one was their aunt and the other was me. I was very, very flattered. So I would go and make them a meal. And not having children myself, I actually would do something like, oh, I'll make this huge pan of a pasta bake and then that'll be enough for dinner and lunch the next day. But no, because it's all gone. And is there more and what else can we have? So I knew the older and the younger quite well. Mm-hmm. But the middle child was very quiet and very typical of middle of three. He's not a typical boy, but that kind of watching and waiting is very typical of middle of three. I like birth age, but birth order is very, very interesting to me. I think it tells mm-hmm. you, it can tell you a lot about people, where you come in the family. And so with a 15-year-old, we watch Dance Moms and she's very lively and we could mm-hmm. talk all of that sort of stuff. And with the older, he was just about to start film school. We could talk about all that. But with the middle, what was our connection? Well, those of you who know teenage boys in particular know that sitting side by side facing forward is the best way to have a conversation with them. So right. Get them in a car, sit on a sofa, and don't compel them to engage with you, and you'll get a long way. So we would sit side by side and watch episodes of Survivor. Mm. I was a very, very casual fan, and he was a fan. And so we were watching a current season, but then he would say, oh, should we watch some old seasons? So we would. Mm-hmm. And we could watch in silence, or we could talk about the show, or we could talk to each other. And so you have this kind of bubble of safety. And mm-hmm. They're all grown up now. They're all in their 20s and they're all wonderful, wonderful young people. I'm very, very lucky to know them. See, I didn't have to have children because my friends had children and, you know, I can borrow them.
Yeah, exactly. You get all the benefits of having kids without yes. all of the costs of having
yes
kids,
exactly. I mean, I knew I will continue with the RHAP journey, but I knew again another memory from the banks is, you know, being 11 or 12 and saying, and people say, oh, when you get married and have children, because that's the way people spoke to girls yeah. in those days, and I would always say, I'm never getting married, I'm never having children, and they would say, ha, 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 ha. Yes, that's a phase yeah. and you'll get over it. Well, I still same. So maybe I will get over it at some point.
Hey, who knows? They told you you'll get over it.
They told me I was going to get over it.
Who knows?
And the interesting thing is when I speak to people who can get pregnant who yeah. have chosen not to and it's never been a choice other than to not, they knew, as I did, really early. It's like it's if you think about a maternal instinct being inside someone, this was the absolute knowledge that we didn't want to have children. And then there are other people who can get pregnant who thought, look, if it happens, it happens, and if it doesn't, I don't mind.
Sure.
And they're happy either way. And then, you know, there are other versions, people who really wanted children and had them, and people who really wanted children and didn't or couldn't or found a different way to have them. So there's a whole we are legion, and there's a whole kind of bouquet of that relationship to children with people who can get pregnant and with people who don't have uteruses as well. They have an attitude about whether to have children or not. So I always knew that I didn't want to have children. Tick, did that, achieved that. And I don't like children in general. People say, oh, I love children. And I'm like, well, which children? Like, which children? They're all different. Mm-hmm. And they're all different people. Luckily, my friends have managed to produce very nice people who who I like a lot. You know, were themselves when they were young and are themselves now. And I love this generation. I mean, I love young people and what they're doing. And this generation is very interesting. And when I say this generation, I mean the ones in their 20s. I think they've had everybody had the hard end of the stick with the pandemic. But with the ones that are around that age, who are the ones that I know who maybe saved for a year to go overseas, and then the pandemic came and they couldn't go. This is what Australian children do, teenagers do. Mm-hmm. Young 20s too. You save for a year, you work really, really hard, save for a year, and then you go overseas because it's a long way and it's very expensive. We did it in the 70s and 80s, and they're doing it in the 2020s, except they didn't get to do it. And now here's the rub. They can't get on Social Security because they have this large amount of money in their bank account. And until they spend it, they can't get on Social Security. And, of course, there were no jobs. So they were very stuck. The ways that they have found to get around the pandemic is extraordinary. Anyway, look, we've all been affected in one way or another. Now, where was I going with all of that? Oh, yes.
Do you know where you were going with all
yes,
that?
I do.
Okay, tell me.
I'm just very grateful to my friends for producing interesting people for me to have relationships with. Mm-hmm. So sitting side by side with this young man and watching Survivor, one day he said, oh, have you heard of the know-it-alls? And I said, oh, no, I haven't. And so he said that perhaps I might like to listen to the know-it-alls. And he was right. I did like to listen to the know-it-alls because there was a season that was going on at the time. And it was the one Aubrey didn't win. Whichever one that is. You see, I'm a bad fan. I don't remember.
It's things. Cool. Yeah, this isn't the Survivor podcast.
No, it's not a Survivor podcast.
For a reason.
And so I listened to them and I saw that there were other podcasts about Survivor, but I thought, oh, I don't want to listen to these other podcasts about Survivor. But then slowly I did. And then, of course, once you have the feed and once you see all the really interesting podcasts coming through, and then after listening for a few years, I thought, oh, I'm getting – and, you know, I think about artists being paid because that's a big thing. Artists are the biggest philanthropists towards the arts all over the world. We're the ones that believe me, if you think that you're donating to the arts, you have no idea what we donate financially and in every other way. Mm-hmm. So I'm very aware of that art has a cost and art should also have a price. A price in terms of your contribution to them making their art. So I thought, oh, I need to be a patron. I need to be a patron. And so I became a patron. And of course, once you become a patron, gosh, you get sucked in, you get drawn in, you get into this incredible community that we're part of. And then, although it was two podcasters outside RHAP that made me want to be a podcaster and think that I could be, it was the opportunity provided by the RHAP Class of 2020 and Rob expanding the roster, let's say, of who the voices were that opened that door for me.
Well, I want to ask you, you know, this is obviously you are the co-host of Crime Scene with the one and only Mari Forth. But I want to ask, do you have any favorite crimes, any favorite types of crimes?
I like heists.
Mm.
Heists and cons. Heists and cons are my favorite. Well, it isn't. Yeah. It could be said that I have not always not broken laws. Let's say
Are you telling me that you were breaking crimes? Is that an admission of guilt?
Maybe.
I cannot confirm or deny. Allegedly. I just keep saying the word allegedly, and that will.
Okay. Well, can I just say that if I did, I have several advantages. One is I look like a good girl. I can't help it. You know, I was a punk in the 70s. I dyed my hair black. I've done everything I can. But I
look like a bad girl. Is that what dyeing your hair black does?
Dyeing hair black is a very bad idea when you're a redhead with pale skin and green eyes. People scream when they realize it's you. I only did that once. I used to dye my hair a lot, but I look law abiding. Put it this way: I look law abiding. So number one, if you want to break laws, look law abiding. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonderful quote: "If you want to break the law, be honest." It's a great one. So people just tend to believe me. People tell me things. So here's the secret about me. People just tell me things. I don't even ask. People tell me all manner of things, often preceded by, oh, look, you probably know this already, like I'm some sort of seer or psychic or something like that. And so people trust me for some reason. They shouldn't. Mm-hmm. They really shouldn't. Word to the wise, any of you, you really shouldn't trust me. Yeah, but I look and sound trustworthy. Right?
You might start a heist here or there. I think I'm a little terrified. I don't want you to give away how you would defraud. Well, I don't know if it'd be fraud.
Let's not name.
we don't need to name the specific crime or how you would do it if it happens.
I am going to. There's a little some special extra bonus content coming for crime scene, and I was going to look up the statute of limitations on a certain criminal activity because I thought, I wonder if I can talk about it because I'm looking for a criminal. If anyone's a criminal, if you've been arrested, charged, been to jail, something like that, can you DM me because I'd love to interview you.
You will probably get a few DMs here and there. I'm sure. Everybody tuning in.
Even if it's minor because, I'm very interested in how we interact with crime.
Yeah. I mean, what I actually am curious about, I have all sorts of questions around this, but like you're diving into this crime scene world and talking mm-hmm. about crimes. And one, like, where does that come from? I could see it in Mari. Cause when we talk about, when Mari and I talk about, not that she's a criminal, disclaimer, she's not. But as far as I know, I am not in on it. Don't question me if there's any crime involved. Shout out to Mari. But, I will say wrestling in itself is one huge crime, if you ask me. I think one day they're going to walk out like a bunch of people, like hundreds of people of a wrestling and just shut it all down. So we're seeing a true crime in real time with that. Yes. But, what do you, I guess I want to ask like a joint question of like, what do you love when it comes to, one, talking with Mari, but also talking with Mari about the crimes?
Well, I love just talking with Mari anyway. She's so funny and smart, and I just she's the best of all people. I think she's wonderful. I like talking with her about crime because she comes from the science analytical side, mm-hmm. and because we're talking about not so much about crime, we're talking about the property. So we're talking about how crime is presented in true mm-hmm. crime, films and documentaries and docuseries and books and podcasts and various things. And so I'm coming at that from a performance art side and she's coming at it from an analytical side, but we meet in the procedural. We both like the procedural side of it. And I think what's interesting is, I mean, it will be no surprise to anybody that we choose our guests very carefully. We have a wonderful roster of guests who want to come on and we very much want to have them on. It's matching them to the true crime, property. You yourself were very carefully matched to the one that you're going to talk about with us. Mm-hmm. And we all come from different places and we all have different thoughts. And really, in a way, true crime documentaries are a vehicle on the podcast for us to talk about what we think about the world. Mm-hmm. And I think in general, there are two things about true crime. One is for women in particular, vulnerable people.
Right.
Let's expand that to vulnerable communities.
Right.
Where you watch it and you go, if I just don't do that, that person who was the victim of that crime did, then I will be safe. Because the apprehension of the danger that we're in is either very present,
right.
slightly present, or in the back of our minds at pretty much all times. And I think for people who move through the world without that apprehension of danger, it is very hard for them to understand how on an absolute day-to-day basis, we check our surroundings, we watch where we are, we tell each other to text me when you get home, we check on each other, we look for escape routes, either overtly or otherwise. So I think what true crime does, and in fact, here's a story. I was meeting some people, I'm meeting a person, a friend, at Town Hall Steps, which is where we all used to meet as teenagers. In the centre of Sydney, there's the Town Hall and there are steps, and that was the great place to meet. So we were going to meet at Town Hall Steps, and I was sitting on a bench waiting for her with my earphones in, and I was really aware of this big man near me. It was daytime. It was like the Sunday afternoon, so I, you know, and lots of people around. But nonetheless, I was very aware of his presence. I moved. He moved. I wasn't going to look at him. And I was already calculating, okay, it's 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. I'm not super scared. I mean, I wasn't scared at all, but I was very aware of him and how he was impinging on my space, impinging on me. I was thinking he may not be aware of me because some people are not aware of the space that they take up, right. both in their physical body and the aura beyond their physical body. And will I move? I could stand. If I casually stand up from the bench and walk over to the steps as I casually wait for my friend. So I have this emotional and mental labor that I'm doing simply because a person, a man, a big man, apparently is standing near me.
Yeah.
And that man could be completely innocent and unaware of me.
Right.
And as it turned out, it was the husband of the person I was waiting for, and he thought it was funny that I didn't realize it was him. And there's no way that I can express to him.
Not a great sense of humor.
I didn't realize it was you, ha ha ha. Because to explain to him what I'd just been through for 3 or 4 minutes, in the most mild way, even, like I never thought for a moment that whoever this stranger was actually a danger to me, although I have been punched in the face in the street by somebody who just came up and punched me.
Oh, my gosh.
During the day. So we do know that men, that was also a man, can just attack us out of nowhere, let alone other very dangerous situations I've been in much more sort of obvious dangers like night or drinking or drugs and various things like that.
Sure.
And I just was, I don't want to make too much of it, but also I don't want to not make too much of it. There's no way to express to this lovely man who I really like that you can't and shouldn't do that to people because what we carry and how we live through the world has an apprehension of danger just built in, just because of who we are and how the world is. So, true crime, we watch it because we say, how do we avoid this happening to us?
Yeah.
So we're seeking to learn. There's also, in the best of true crime, and the one, we tend to like the things that we talk about, although we spectacularly, all three of us did not like something recently, but then it was an amusing thing to talk about, and also like why. But well-made true crime is a work of art, and when you have a good director telling a story in a compelling fashion, it has the pull of a great play or a great film. And for me, that's the pull of true crime, and probably less so the how do I avoid it. Some people find it very soothing because it's not them. And we have the satisfaction when the person gets caught, or the outrage when they get caught but not punished, or the frisson of fear when they are never caught, and he's still out there to this day, is the sort of delicious frisson that we have. That's why we like horror stories when we're children, because of that fear. But it's a very safe fear because we're being told a story in a very safe position. So that's why I like true crime. And that's why I like talking about anything, but particularly true crime, with Mari.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, even just looking at the story you share. I mean, there's so much that, well, that makes me think about a lot of things. Like, I, as a man, I would say I'm very aware of how I'll say, especially as a Black man, because that's another big dimension of this. It's like if I'm walking down the street in general, you know, I'm aware that as a, and you know this because we met in person too, but 6 foot, you know, something Black man, you know, that could be perceived in a certain way by someone. And I do think that there are, you know, I think men could do a lot better, because like this is one thing that I think is so interesting about the world. I have a background that includes like doing a lot of work in terms of consent and sexual assault and working with survivors a bit. And that made me very, especially aware of masculinity also. And I also had, did a bit of work when it came to like working with men, when it comes to what our masculinity means and what that is. And like, we could all really do better in terms of like understanding that it's not funny. But also I think maybe to try to tie some pieces together, like one podcasting. No, I could do it. I figured it out.
But I was actually just going to say,
please.
I could just jump in. I mean, I'm tall as well. So there's a thing about height.
Yeah.
I'm not as tall as you. I'm not quite 6 feet tall, but I am tall. I'm tall for
a woman. You are very tall.
For when I was a teenager, I was very tall, taller than everybody. But now, of course, not so much. And I think there's a way that certainly as a tall woman, I have damped down my energy or my enthusiasm or my thrust in the world, as it were, in a way that a shorter person doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be so aware, because we're aware of looming over people. That's one. Another one is, if you are a man listening to this podcast and you have no intention to predate on women or anybody, other people,
right,
we're not talking about you. But you can be aware of, I think it's the thing of the outrage that I see sort of online and speaking to men who say, I was walking behind her and she turned around or she hurried or I didn't have any bad intention. And I say, yes, but we don't know that.
Yeah.
So in the story of my friend, he knew he had no bad intention. But given my experience in the world, I have no reason to trust that this figure had no bad intention. So don't be outraged about being attacked as a man. You're not being attacked. What we're asking you to do is understand our experience and how you unknowingly can contribute to our apprehension of danger, or how you knowingly can contribute to our feeling of safety. For example, I have been walking in the street at night and there's the footsteps behind and I glance just to see who it is. And it's a man, and they will sort of move out of the same line as me and hurry past me. And I think that's a deliberate act by that man to demonstrate to me that I'm not in danger.
Yeah.
So
I'll do that all the time. That type of thing, slash literally like, let me walk on that side of the street so I don't have the awkward moment of that person crossing the street because they feel threatened by me, which obviously there are many levels to that.
Yeah.
Right.
We've all crossed the street. I've had a man come up and ask me for directions to a place that was in the direction I was walking. And I gave him directions in the completely wrong direction. And I could see in his face, he knew exactly where the place was. He just wanted to walk with me. And now he's stuck because if he walks with me, I told him it was the other. So, I think, but it's not just a man walking behind a vulnerable person at night. It's also, I must receive the cries for understanding of, you know, people of color, of black people, of, non-binary people. Mm. Because I know that I am doing things, whatever my intention, that impinge on their feeling of safety and security. So instead of saying, but I'm not racist, I have to say, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Where is my energy going and where is my lack of thoughtfulness going that I am impinging and endangering, you know, other vulnerable people? So it's for all of us to, it's not just white men, but it is also white men.
And I'll say, I will say, like, often it is white men, often it is men. And I think that men especially, we often have a way of, in our society, making it about us. I think that it's like, why are you treating me in this way? Why are you looking at me in this way? I didn't do it. That wasn't my intention. And it's like, get over yourself is what I would say. The less, because you said everything very, I think, in a very fair and reasonable way. I'd say, you know, get out of yourself and think, how could you be better and show up for people more? And like, how could you listen to people's perspectives? Like, listen to more women to understand the lives that they're kind of, or try understand more, you know, because like, we could never fully understand the walk that someone else has, but understand more like what someone else is going through. Even listening to this conversation, someone will think, oh, I wasn't thinking about myself. I thought that was funny, that silly thing I thought that I was doing that was a joke or that was harmless or whatever. It's like, we could all do better. And I love that people could listen to you and Mari and learn about these things in passing, depending on what you're talking about. Like, some of these conversations come up. Even when me and Mari are talking about wrestling, some of these conversations come up. And I think one of the great ways that people could just be more informed about how to be like better neighbors or global citizens or community members or whatever you want to call it is by like listening to other people. And that's what this podcast and like podcasting and theater even could be about. It communicates a lot of these messages to people.
Well, one of the great and deep pleasures that I have about Crime Scene, and this is not something that Mari and I ever discussed, every episode race comes up. And I'm delighted because everything is about race. Yes, you're right. You are right. Everything is about race. Mm-hmm. So even when we were talking about the case in Denmark, so we're talking about Scandinavian people, of which I am, it's my heritage. There's still race there because the tolling bell was, and it happened to her in Denmark. And look, she went to all these dangerous places. Yeah, dangerous places where dangerous brown people are, is what you're saying. And it had happened to her in safe white Scandinavia. So I love that it comes up. I want it to come up because it informs. If I say everything, is that overstating it? No. But I want to hear it. And Mari, if you're listening, we never discussed it, but I want to say I'm very glad that it does come up from either of us or indeed from our guests.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing I want to say before, as we kind of wrap up and get to that point in the show, one thing I want to acknowledge, and maybe I'll set you up for this. So, Sarah, when you're on podcasts, you're introducing yourself, you talk about where you are, and you always acknowledge being on unceded Cadigal land, which I think is very, very interesting for a lot of reasons. One, on most podcasts, we don't hear land acknowledgments of the ancestral or indigenous stolen lands necessarily, right? And I think that, I just kind of want to give you the space in talking. We're talking about people's experiences and a little bit about identity here, but in short, at least, why is that so? I'll say, as someone who is coming to you from unceded Anacostan land here in Washington, D.C., and as someone who also, you know, first experienced a land acknowledgement the one time I visited Australia, Perth, I want to ask for you, why is that so important to acknowledge that every time that you're, you know, you kind of show up on a podcast or wherever you show up? Because I'm sure you acknowledge where you are and where you're coming from in a multitude of venues.
Yes. Well, some of the venues are, it's my email signature has, I live and work on unceded Gadigal land. It's interesting that you said Gadigal because you can say it either way. These are the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and sovereignty was never ceded. And I do acknowledge elders past, present, and emerging. So you can do an acknowledgement in any way that you like. You're taking a moment to say, we're on stolen land.
Right.
And the feeling that I have is like we were talking about with men saying, but it wasn't me. It's a lot of white Australians say, I didn't do it. And I think the fight at the moment, or the discussion at the moment, or the, I don't know, it's not a discussion. It's just like, shut up and listen.
Yeah.
White Australian, well, we say white Australia has a black history. White Australians benefited from the invasion, from the stealing of the land, and continue to benefit from the downplaying, downholding of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, who are the original custodians of the land.
Mm-hmm.
They knew how to husband the land, as the saying goes. So how to do controlled burning, how to live on the land. I mean, it's a strange, stark land, full of possibilities to live if you know the land, if you walk on the land. And many of the climate, environmental problems that we're having in Australia, the Indigenous people know the answer. Just go and ask them. When I first started doing, it's called an acknowledgement of country here.
Right.
I did feel awkward and strange. Some Aboriginal people don't want it. Some couldn't care less. Some like it. So, you know, if you want to know what Aboriginal people think, ask them.
Right.
What's very beautiful and moving is a welcome to country. A welcome to country is from someone whose country it is. So they will welcome you to the place that you're standing. That's very moving. And, for example, that a lot of thought needs to be given. For example, if you're in a meeting, and a meeting, a formal meeting of some kind, I've seen this happen, where the person running the meeting turns to the only Aboriginal person in the room and says, oh, perhaps you would like to do the acknowledgement of country.
Right.
And at one meeting I was in, the Aboriginal man said, it's not my country. I'll do it, but me doing it is the same as you doing it.
Right.
It's like you have to understand, we don't understand, but to apprehend what we've done and how much further we have to go. For example, how you can't hear the stark news of when COVID first came and there were talks about, you know, dangers, and then the vaccine first came, and if you were over 60, you could get it, or over 50 if you were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. How you can hear those kind of things and not understand that 10-year difference in health and health outcomes, in the carceral system, in, I could go on, and I am not qualified to talk about it. So I can only talk about it from my point of view, that for every person that says, well, haven't we finished saying sorry, we white people? Haven't we finished saying sorry? I would say, well, haven't we finished saying thank you to the Anzacs? So we have a big thing, which is Anzac Day, which is the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, and it's this reverence for men who went off and fought wars. And I don't say that lightly. I know it's very important to people. And every year we have an Anzac Day. It's a march. There's a dawn ceremony.
Sure.
It's a very, very important moment. Well, we're still thanking the Anzacs
That's like our Veterans Day, for example. Yeah,
and there aren't many World War II veterans left, so mm-hmm. their children and their grandchildren march with the medals on the other side, and that's great. We're still saying thank you, so why aren't we still saying sorry?
Ooh, that's so deep, and I think it's really powerful and important, and something that it makes me think of, without going all the way into it, is even just like how important it is to, I'll say, not only atone for that history, but recognize the impact that it has to this day. And you could definitely think of parallels here in the U.S., not only when it comes to Indigenous peoples and different communities here, but also when it comes to slavery and race and a lot of different. And I don't only mean like Black people in slavery, but also, when we think of like Japanese internment camps and other things like this. And so it's important that we acknowledge it because it does affect how we interact with people to this day. I'll mention to you that the one week I was in Perth, which, by the way, Australia is a place that I hope I'll visit you soon in Sydney or at some point at least. But, even then, I remember going to the bar there after a long week at work with folks on this straight project in Perth. And the bar was empty at first. I was with a bunch of coworkers who were white. I was the only Black coworker. And I was waiting at the bar and I'm waiting. And I'm like, I'm not getting served for some reason. And I could not get served for the life of me at this. And this is 2016, people. Like, this is not that long ago. And so there's still a lot of reckoning and engaging with these topics and processing that needs to be done and understanding why it's important to take time to understand and, really process what is my living in today's world, what is my individual role in this bigger systemic problem? And also how are each of us not only impacted by this history, but how are each of us kind of, playing a role in perpetuating it? Right. And I think that it's cool. It's cool that you kind of acknowledge, you bring that acknowledgement of country into the podcast. And hopefully it's made people think, what is this? What is going on with this? And, it's one resource.
Literally the least
you could do. And one resource I've heard people point to a lot, because it's becoming a lot more popular in spaces I'm in, especially working in like the climate world, where I think people are more and more becoming aware of like, what's the world around us? Who are the communities around us? Environmental justice and the like. There's a website, native-land.ca, which is a great way of just looking up your location and seeing and learning, if you kind of click, like learning more about whose land it is and who is there. And so I want to just thank you for bringing that into our world and our universe in a way that it's not, currently present, obviously, on podcasts. I don't find myself doing land acknowledgments, honestly, ever on podcasts, but it is something that I'm glad that we could talk about and acknowledge. And I'm sure people are learning from this conversation. I wish we could go on forever, Sarah. There's so much more we could talk about. I have one more question, though, that I want to dive into with you. And that's a callback to you mentioning being a swimming coach. That was totally intentional pun. I like to ask folks, about their life and about their story. And the question I'll ask you is that if your life were a book or documentary, what would the title be?
I knew there was some prep I should do. I said to you before we started, it's really weird. I feel like I haven't done any prep, and it was in the back of my mind and I completely forgot. Wow. Oh, no. This is the worst.
I think people like there's as you think about this for a second, I will mm-hmm. say, I swear I don't like to watch people squirm.
Yes,
I don't
you do.
Like to, no, I'm stalling. And you know, Sarah, you have a title. I know it's on the tip of your tongue. That title, if of your life, book, or documentary. Now tell us, Sarah, what
Let's
is
go.
The title?
Exclamation mark! Don't forget the exclamation mark.
Let's go. And why?
Well, that's sort of, I am still impetuous. I still leap before I look. I still am just want to dive, as it were, straight into things. And that can be not so good. But it can also be good. Like, stop planning to do it and just do it. Stop getting ready to do it and just do it. Let's go. Like, what?
Yeah.
One thing I will say is just do it. The things that this is nothing that people haven't said before. The things you regret are the things you didn't do. I've done things that I regret, but it's the undone things and the unsaid things that I regret more. So what's stopping you from doing this thing? So people say, I remember somebody once saying, oh, you know, I went to New York. I've been traveling to New York for 30 years. I love it. I have friends mm-hmm. there. It was fantastic to go in a different sort of capacity when we were all there together in May. And I remember coming back from there or about to go to there, and somebody said, oh, I wish I could go to New York. It's like, well, go. Like, don't wait for an invitation. That could be the other title, other than Let's Go Exclamation Mark, is Don't Wait for an Invitation.
Maybe that's the subtitle.
Or the other way around. Don't wait for an invitation. Let's go. Now we're getting to see. Now we are overthinking it. Don't wait for an invitation. I'm not going to say that life is really short. It is. Mm. But it's also really long, and there are consequences. But do the thing, say the thing, write the thing, make the thing, move. One thing I will say from my great perch of wisdom at 81 years old is when we're younger, we feel like the decisions that we make are permanent. Some of them are. Mm-hmm. But you can, I want to move cities. Oh, shall I move cities? And you ask everybody, should you move cities? And this feeling is that when you move cities, that's the last city you're ever going to live in. That's not the case. That's just what you're doing for now. So if you think about, too, these decisions are not necessarily permanent. You can go and try it.
Right.
It's like the food. I try every food. I have very distinct likes and dislikes, mm-hmm. but I've tried everything at least once that I don't like. Because sometimes I come back to it and go, maybe I do like, no, I don't like that.
Yeah.
So the idea of trying things, the idea of get a little leap before you look in you. If you're curious, follow the path. Have a plan, but be flexible about the plan. That's what all that Let's Go, I think, is about. Otherwise, who among us would do anything, really? Because there is much to be scared of, actually, emotionally. And in our minds, there was a famous self-help book when self-help books were sort of igniting in the 80s called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. I never read the book, but I like that title.
Right.
Because it says, of course you're scared to do it. I'm scared to leave home. I'm scared to leave this relationship. I'm scared to start this relationship. I'm scared to let people know who I am. By the way, you don't have to let people know who you are. That is yours to give or not to give.
Mm-hmm.
We're all scared. If you're not, you're a sociopath because you don't have that. You know, part of our fear is mm-hmm. empathy for ourselves. Mm-hmm. I will be embarrassed if I, for example, I know you said to wrap up, but the other day, so a person who's very important to me is David Bowie. Mm-hmm. He understood me. Personally, all songs that I heard in the late 60s and through the 70s that he sang, that he wrote were incredible, right to my soul. And I was lucky enough to see him in concert 3 times, the first time when I was 18. And I also like, you know, music has moved on. I like now music as well. Mm-hmm. But I was in a small grocery store the other day, and a young, what I assumed was a queer person behind the counter was there, and I was there, and a David Bowie song came on, and I started grooving, and I started sort of slightly singing it under my breath, and we looked at each other, and I said, oh, David Bowie is really important to me. And this person poured their soul out about wow. how much David Bowie meant to them. And they were young, like they were a teen person.
Yeah.
And we had this nice moment of connection. We saw each other, as it were. So if I had been scared to groove in a grocery store and sing a David Bowie song,
wow.
I wouldn't have connected with this wonderful young person who I'll almost certainly never see again. Good luck to them. So, yeah, if you want to dance in a supermarket aisle, do it. I mean, that sounds so naff and so white. But what I mean is it doesn't matter. One of the things that's great is it doesn't matter. You'll never see those people again. Oh, but what if I screamed with laughter in the middle of the street? It doesn't matter. You're never going to see any of those people again. Mm-hmm. And some of my worst regrets where I said or did something really terrible, I sometimes think to myself, it doesn't matter now. All those people are dead, which That's is true. Real. They are.
Yeah.
I'm the only one that, why am I carrying that? Why am I carrying that? So in a sort of less dramatic way, you're never going to see that person again. Oh, I would have liked to have taken my clothes off and jumped in that fountain. Let's just do it. No, you're never going to see all those people again. You know, the police might have something to say about it. But
well, they might see you depending on the, you know, the security camera.
Depending on the circumstance.
They might put you on a few flyers. But other than that, you know, if it's.
Have you seen this bum?
Yeah. Well, I mean, who knows? Yeah. I feel like that's the note to end on. No, that's what, I mean, I guess you probably have if you were out by the fountain when they took their clothes off. Sarah, thank you so much. Thank you so much for all of this. Thank you for being. What's our relationship again? We are pod. Are we podcasters in law?
Pods in law.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being my pod in law and for being part of Pod Friends.
Wow. Thank you so much for tuning into this conversation with Sarah. It went so many different places, and I'm thankful to just be able to sit back and learn from and listen to Sarah and connect with her and hear more, at least a little bit more about her path and her story. And also recognize that with all these Pod Friends interviews, there is so much more to dive into with the folks that you hear from and that I hear from in these conversations. And so again, you can subscribe to robiswebsite.com/podfriendsfeed. That's robiswebsite.com/podfriendsfeed for a number of exciting conversations coming this summer for Pod Friends. And as always, follow me at Matt Scott GW on social media. Follow at Hey Pod Friends on social media. And just a few quick plugs. You could check me out on the Wrestling Rehap Up, another RHAP podcast. This one focused on pro wrestling with Mari Forth at robhiswebsite.com/wrestlingfeed. You could check out The Pride Has Spoken, which was all about Survivor with Dr. Evie Jagoda from Survivor 41 and with fellow Class of 2020 podcaster Grace Leader. And you can check that out at robhiswebsite.com/pridefeed. And speaking of Survivor, I also just want to plug that I was part of a fantastic live reality game, Survivor Philadelphia. The theme, Head versus Heart. Hope you can check it out. I know it'll be a lot of fun. Not entirely sure what to expect, and honestly a little nervous watching it all unfold, seeing everyone's perspectives along the way. And my cast profile video was posted this week, so you can check that out at Survivor Philadelphia on social media, or you can go to bit.ly, that's bit.ly/survivorHVH, bit.ly/survivorHVH. That's for head versus heart. So that's all I've got for now. But without further ado, I just want to thank you so much for being here on the journey. Encourage you to tune in next week. And as always, I want to thank you for being a pod friend.